Good morning and welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the most vital segment of our society, to those of you like me who know that there is something troubling, even destructive, about the religious and political, the media and military institutions that are so active in our world, all of which claim to be providing solutions, all of which are actually the problem. We realize that these institutions cannot be fixed, that it isn't a matter of trying to rearrange the color of the deck chairs on our Titanic of state. So our mission is to scour the news so that we understand who is causing the tragedies that are besieging our world, what is the nature of these religions and political schemes, all while predicting how these events will influence our world so you are better prepared. Then in our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His guidance regarding His covenant provides the only glimmer of hope in an exceedingly troubled world. Anytime over the next 2 hours, if you'd like to join in this discussion, our number is toll-free, 877-300-7645. Yesterday, we were talking a bit about the U.S. deficit and the stalemate between the Obama administration and the U.S. Congress. And the president has decided that, once again, he does not want to negotiate. He does not view himself in the role of being the elected head of one of three branches of government that have to work together to establish law. He views himself as a demagogue, as I don't have to negotiate. I'm not going to go down to their level. They either have to agree with me or they're wrong. When the nation has had in its past issues with budgets and issues with deficits, it was always through compromise that the debt ceiling was raised. It was always through compromise that the budgetary process had some constraints placed on it. It is what happened with the contract in America during the Newt Gingrich congressional rise to influence when Bill Clinton was president. And during that time, the Republicans in Congress said, yeah, we'll work with you to raise the debt ceiling, but if we do so, it will be on these terms. And those terms were imposed, largely. And what they did is they turned an ever-rising deficit into a surplus. Then we went away from that kind of governance, and we had a Republican in the White House and a Republican Congress, and they turned a $250 billion surplus into a $1.4 trillion deficit. And that's where we find ourselves today, particularly now with a president who views himself above the fray, someone who is almost messianic in their approach. Well, the IMF director, Christine Lagarde, now wants to scold the American people and Congress and saying that a failure to raise the U.S. debt ceiling would be far worse to the global economy than the current shutdown. So she's saying the shutdown is bad. Failure to raise the debt ceiling would be far worse. Of course, she is head of the International Monetary Fund, whose stated purpose is to borrow money and to play Robin Hood around the world, taking money from those who are productive and giving it to those who are not. It is a deficit-born game, and the United States is the biggest player in deficits. Ms. Lagarde's comments, however, were echoed by the U.S. Treasury. It is also signs that we have approached a one-world political and economic solution, which is counterproductive to the interests of virtually everyone except those who are the elitist at the top of it. What the International Bank says is what American bankers now say. They say that a debt default would lead to a financial crisis as bad as 2008 or worse. The 2008 crisis, if you want to call the Great Recession of 2008 a crisis, was caused because the government manipulated private banking interests such that loans were provided to those who could not afford them at artificially low rates and that by manipulating the home loan market, and as I say, making loans that were typically 100%, 95 and 100% of the assessed value of a home, as opposed to a maximum of 80%, so that the buyer of the home didn't have to put any equity in the home. So it was 100% loan on adjustable rate mortgages, which were artificially set at a low rate that would go up, and when they went up, it would make the 100% loan on the home unaffordable for the purchaser, causing them to default, which would then flood the market with homes that were now in default, foreclosed, which would then drive down the value of those homes, which would cause all of the other people who had bought homes artificially at low rates at very high borrowing percentages to default on their loans because their homes would no longer be worth what was owed against them. They would have negative equity. That's what caused the 2008 recession. It was born out of government involvement, malfeasance in the private banking sector. And now what she's saying is that if we don't continue to destroy the U.S. currency, to continue to inflate our money so it becomes less valuable, that we will return to the conditions that we were in back in a time when the U.S. government was manipulating the private banking sector. Now, Mr. Obama says that this is a reckless act, that as reckless, he says, as a government shutdown is. Now, well, the only reason the government is shut down is that Obama is refusing to negotiate, refusing to talk about anything, won't give an inch. As reckless as the government shutdown is, as many people are being hurt by a government shutdown, an economic shutdown that results from a default would be dramatically worse. So just raise the debt ceiling. No restraints. I'm God. You have no rights to tell me what I can and cannot do. Obama, of course, has gone so far as to say, take a vote, stop this farce, and end the shutdown right now. Well, here's the reality, and we talked about this briefly in yesterday's program. In 1980, the U.S. deficit in aggregate was less than $1 trillion. By 1990, it was $3 trillion. By 2000, it was $5 trillion. By 2010, it was $14 trillion. It went from $5 trillion to $14 trillion in a decade. Right now, it is estimated that the fiscal year 2013, you know, the government's year is not a calendar year, it is a fiscal year, the total deficit is going to be $17.5 trillion. And while the deficits are rising at an aggregate rate greater than at any time in American history, the President of the United States is in full denial. He says that deficits have been falling in their fastest rate in 60 years. This year, Obama will add $900 billion to the deficit. Since he has been in office during the first 5 years, he has added almost $7 billion in aggregate debt. So Mr. Obama added that in his view, unlike budget battles in the past, the shutdown was not about ideological differences resulting on how much the federal government should be spending, noting that deficits have been falling at their fastest pace in 60 years. Yes, that is really a fall. 2000 was $5 trillion, 2005, $8 trillion, 2010, $14 trillion, and fiscal year 2013, $17.5 trillion. Do you see any part of that that appears to be falling? You know, when the truth doesn't fit your agenda, lie is the mantra of politicians. And if the general public that is listening isn't willing to invest the time to shed their ignorance or to be rational, then why not blatantly lie? And that is what this administration is doing. He said, this is not about spending. This is not about fiscal responsibility. This whole thing is about one thing, the Republican's obsession with dismantling the Affordable Care Act, he said. citing his signature domestic legislature initiative. Well, the fact is that, and we went over this about a week ago, that if you break down the federal government into the areas of spending, the largest area of spending by far is in Medicare and Medicaid. And it is not only the largest government expenditure, and I'm sorry that this president does not think that that trying to rein in as opposed to radically increase spending in the greatest area of expense for the U.S. government isn't about fiscal responsibility, but not only is Medicare and Medicaid the largest portion of the U.S. budget, portion of the U.S. budget that was zero in 1965. It's gone from zero in 1965 to about 35 to 36% of the U.S. budget. And it is by far the fastest growing segment. And so the Republicans are saying your Affordable Care Act hasn't made health care more affordable for anyone. Those who were paying for their health care, those who are responsible, have seen their premium skyrocket, and the level of covered events diminish. I mean, almost all of us who pay for our own health care have opted to have much less quality insurance and are paying a much higher premium for it. And that's universal. That's the opposite of affordable. And the purpose of the Affordable Care Act wasn't to make healthcare affordable for those who are paying for it, which in a country that was once made great by free enterprise would be a noble undertaking. It was to make healthcare free for those who didn't want to or couldn't pay for it. And so by adding a third more participants amongst those who were the poorest in society, all that Obamacare is going to do is increase, and dramatically, the burden of health care upon the U.S. government. It is why the Republicans are opposed to funding it. We are already in debt nearly $18 trillion. This will take it to $20 trillion. In a related story, we find this from Reuters, that and you might say, how is this related? But trust me, it is. Turkey has attempted to purchase $4 billion in Chinese weaponry. In particular, Chinese defense missiles. It was considered a monumental breakthrough for China. The United States, of course, is having a tizzy fit because the United States is by far the largest supplier of weaponry around the world. But China is rising quickly. China's weapon sales have increased 162% in the last 5 years. China has just this year passed the United Kingdom as the fifth biggest arms supplier in the world. Now, to say that they have just passed the United Kingdom, they're still a drop in the bucket compared to the United States. So the United States is saying no to Turkey, you can't buy the Chinese weapon systems because you're part of NATO, and as part of NATO, you have to buy ours. Well, the reason that the Turks want to buy the Chinese system is not only is it a much better value than the U.S. system, but the Chinese are willing to co-manufacture the missiles in Turkey, and they're willing to do what America won't do, and it's really handicapping America's industry around the world, because the United States will not allow any company to manufacture goods outside of the United States without securing all technology that company has developed. For example, General Electric makes is the largest manufacturer of jet engines. The Chinese are developing their own version of the 737, the Boeing 737, the Airbus A320. And the Chinese want to co-manufacture portions of the engine in China, which is similar to what Airbus demands of GE, which is why GE owns so many companies and is partnered with so many companies throughout France and Italy. is because these big airlines are typically part of the government, and they want their people employed. But the U.S. government won't allow GE, even on a civilian jet engine, to engage in co-manufacturing capabilities. So the Chinese are willing to do that. The U.S. companies cannot do that. They're restricted from doing so, which is a huge negative influence on American industries, which is why America is no longer the leading manufacturing country in the world. China is now in that role because they partner better than the United States does. The other thing that's interesting about this story is that China's largest military customer of military hardware happens to be Pakistan, the very same nation that America provides about $3 billion worth of weaponry and armaments a year. A government that has nuclear capability, and China has intercontinental ballistic missile technology. You marry the two, with China now being the largest weapon supplier to Pakistan. You marry the two, and all of a sudden, the Chinese have enabled the Pakistanis to send their nuclear bombs to any race in the world. And now you realize that because of the American invasion of Afghanistan, where we pushed the Taliban, which we originally worked with to as an ally, but now as our stated enemy, we pushed them out of Afghanistan into Pakistan, where they have sought to destabilize that country. And eventually, the fundamentalist Muslims will gain control of Pakistan's nuclear arsenal that will be on the top of Chinese intercontinental ballistic missiles. And there's nothing America can do about it because, as I say, these two stories are related. The largest supplier of U.S. debt are the Chinese. The Chinese are in a unique position where if they were to demand fair interest rates for their bonds, for the treasury bonds that they buy, then they would devalue their holdings, because if you increase the interest rates on new bonds, you decrease the value of the old bonds at lower rates. And so they're not in a position to force the U.S. to raise interest rates to 5 to 10%, which is really what they where they need to be, because it devalues their present holdings, but they're not willing to buy nearly as many bonds at the artificially low rate. So it's the reason that the Federal Reserve has been playing a shell game with quantitative easing and buying treasury bills with their own notes. And, of course, their notes become debt for the U.S. government and therefore are passed on to the U.S. taxpayer. It is all a shell game, and when you're dealing in a shell game where you're overtly opposed to the one nation that is keeping you from being bankrupt, that is still willing to service your debt, then you're playing Russian roulette. And in this case, every chamber is live. Shattering this, I'm your host, Yana. You can participate in this program. We would encourage you to call in. The toll-free number, as you know, is 877-300-7645. We're going to turn the page now and move beyond America's financial bankruptcy to what happened day before yesterday with the U.S. government, this administration, deciding that it was entitled to be the police force in the world. That sense of entitlement, by the way, that says that national sovereignty and national borders are irrelevant to us. If we want to bomb Syria, we can bomb Syria. If we want to send drones over Pakistan, we'll send drones and over Pakistan and kill whomever we see fit to kill. Now, if we want to invade Libya because there's somebody there that we want to capture, if we want to invade Somalia because there's somebody there we want to kill, national sovereignty means nothing to us. We are the de facto police force of the world, the moral enforcement unit of the world. It is arrogant in the extreme, and of course it is counterproductive to take that approach. Well, I'd like to share a little bit about the fellow that America allegedly went in to kill in Somalia. Americans very seldom go into a country to capture. We didn't go in to capture Osama bin Laden. Had he been brought to trial, it would have been a tremendous embarrassment for the U.S. government. We go in to kill. We are not a nation of law anymore that tries to properly investigate and then properly judge an individual. We condemn first, we kill second. So here's the story. CNN is reporting here. He said, he is merciless towards opponents, secretive to the point of being a recluse, and a true believer in the cause of global jihad. If you're a true believer in the cause of global jihad, you are a fundamentalist Muslim. It didn't say that, of course. And from his hideout somewhere in the northern regions, somewhere in the southern regions, I should say, of Somalia, Mukhtar Abu Zabir is the emir of Al-Shabaab. Now, Al-Shabaab in Arabic means the lads, the youth. It is a cobbled-together Islamic terrorist group comprised of young boys, typically in the range of 14, 15, 16 years old. They are, of course, in a country where starvation is rampant, and so they recruit these young boys by robbing the caravans of food and medicines and the like that are provided by Western countries. And when they confiscate those, they'll go into public areas and they'll offer a 13, 14, 15-year-old boy a piece of fruit each day. Say, you go fight for us, we'll make certain that you get something to eat every day. That is how they are cobbled together. It is a disgusting expression of fundamentalist Islam. Well, this particular fellow, Zubair, planned the terrorist attack in Kenya. In Kenya on the shopping center. He thought that he was doing himself and his God a favor by going into a public shopping mall and taking hostages and murdering those who sought to rebel. It was stated as the deadliest attack in Kenya since the U.S. Embassy bombing back in 1998. So Zubair, who is also known as Ahmad Abdi Godane, already had a price on his head. Last year, the U.S. State Department authorized a reward up to $7 million for information on his whereabouts. It's interesting. The U.S. State Department has taken the same approach that the CIA has taken. You know, the CIA does not have operatives in the Islamic world. We have none. I mean, none. I mean, this notion that the CIA has its spies and its spies infiltrate inside of the Islamic world, which, of course, is the only overt enemy of America at this point, is just not true. All we do is we seek to bribe certain Muslims, hoping that they can infiltrate the Islamic terrorist cells and that they will, once inside, turn on their fellow Muslim brothers and, based upon what we're paying them, and spill the goods. Of course, 100% of the time, they go in and they'll go to the head of whatever the organization is, says, I'm being paid to snoop on you. Here's the money, for the good of the jihadist cause, and what do you want me to tell them? So that, you know, we keep them in the dark. That's America's approach. And so America is now offering money to so they can take people out. It's kind of what the mob once became famous for doing. As we continue to study this particular story, it says that his compound, this was on Saturday, was the target of a U.S. commando raid. Now, just think from the point of view of being President of the United States. The last time that Americans were engaged in Somalia was Black Hawk Down. Bill Clinton didn't want to show force. He wanted Americans to be part of the UN peacekeeping effort. And so they were sent in to protect the supply lines of food to this Islamic country. And while they were there, they were running also commando operations trying to capture and kill the most deadly of the Islamists. Well, they were under-equipped, And here Americans sent on foot to conduct these kinds of raids were ambushed. It was eminently foreseeable that this would occur. And then the United States did not have enough equipment to withdraw them, sent in Black Hawk helicopters to try to rescue the Americans. The rotors were shot off of those helicopters. They crashed. And one of the most horrific scenes ever. And so what are you going to do? You're going to tell the young men and women who signed up to join the U.S. military that, you know, you're really not going to defend American freedom. What we're going to do is we're going to send you back into Somalia. Now, this raid may have gone well with few deaths attributed to the jihadist. But what if it hadn't? What was to be gained? You know, when you kill one jihadist, does it make a difference? Or do you leave 100 in the wake of the one that you killed? Anyway, the SEAL teams went in, and after a fierce firefight, it became unclear whether or not their target was killed, wounded, or dead or alive. Zubair's vision had been to transform al-Shabaab from an insurgent outfit focused on Somalia to a terrorist group capable of devastating attacks beyond its borders. Again, it's the lads. It's 14, 15, 16-year-old boys with guns. He had already directed two suicide bombings against bars in Uganda's capital in 2010, and then this September, the Westgate Mall siege in Nairobi, Kenya. For Zubair, the struggle has always been a global confrontation with disbelievers. The CNN journalist had to put that in quotes because they didn't want to themselves be identified with someone who might be conveying the fact that Zubair was a fundamentalist Muslim and that the Quran itself orders Muslims to fight and kill non-Muslims until the only religion on earth is Islam. They can't be bothered to do the research and actually read the Quran or the Islamic Hadith, so they'll just put it in quotes. He also vowed that his group would launch direct attacks against the United States. Well, the United States is considered by Muslims to be a country that is not only willing to wage war against Islam, but also a country that they view is being supportive of Israel, which the Quran orders Muslims to hate and to annihilate. Now, what is interesting here is that the opposite is true, but truth has never intervened in the minds of those who are religious. The reality is the United States sells between 25 and 30 times more weaponry to the Islamic nations that are Israel's enemies than it does to Israel. We're empowering Muslims to the tune of almost 30 times a greater rate than we provide weapons to Israel. As we continue this story, Zubair is an overachiever. He's twice the age of his average jihadist, but he's 36 years old, according to most accounts. He is from Somaliland, an autonomous region in North Somalia. He is, as a teenager, he studied at a Pakistan madrasa. He was given a grant to study there by a wealthy Saud, a member of the royal family. There is a connection here that we ought not miss. America views both Pakistan and Saudi Arabia as allies in the war against terrorism. The most effective schools in the world for manufacturing terrorists are in Pakistan. The Pakistani madrasas are where the Taliban is conceived and where most of the most essentially ruthless Islamic jihadists in the world are indoctrinated. Those madrasas are almost universally paid for, as well as the mosques and the reading material by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the fuel that empowers Islamic terrorism. Pakistan is a state, has more state-sponsored Islamic terrorist organizations than any other country in the world. Vastly more than Iran. You know, Iran does have Hezbollah, but Pakistan not only has the Taliban, but at least 20 other fundamentalist Islamic terrorist groups that are active around the world. It is the leading state sponsor of terrorism. And the country most responsible for funding the reading material and the mosques and the madrasas that indoctrinate young men and women to be terrorists, to be Islamic jihadists, is Saudi Arabia. Literally, America, by buying Saudi oil, is funding our own demise. So as a teenager, he studied at a Pakistani madrasa, thanks to a grant from a wealthy Saud, and he returned to his home with militant beliefs and an appetite for trouble. Yeah, you come out of any Islamic school, and you will be a jihadist. It is impossible, according to the Quran, to be a Muslim and not be a jihadist. The ninth surah of the Quran makes it absolutely and abundantly clear. If you claim to be peaceful, you cease to be a Muslim. You are called a hypocrite, according to the Quran. If you are peaceful as a Muslim, you cease to be a Muslim, and then Allah tells the good jihadist Muslims to kill you so that Allah himself can torture the peaceful Muslim in the hottest places of hell. So this is the story of how this terrorist was born. We'll continue in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about what took place in Somalia. We don't really have much of the details and don't expect the truth out of the U.S. Government in terms of what actually went down in the raid. It's not something that Americans do very well in terms of the truth. And that before it, someone who may be listening saying, you know, well, you know, it's the U.S. military. They can't divulge what they're doing. Otherwise, they put lives at risk. It's just nonsense. The reality is that I lost all confidence or respect for the U.S. military as I investigated the first 500 deaths in Afghanistan and in Iraq. I wrote a book about them. It's called The Islamic Terrorism Timeline. And what I learned is that of the first 500 Americans to die in the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, both of which were counterproductive. They were suicidal missions. They made a bad situation worse. That the U.S. government actually was responsible for the deaths of most of those who were killed. We either foolishly sent them into harm's way with inadequate protection, or it was friendly fire, or it was a situation where they were told that they were going in to fight a military-style battle against a actual army to depose a despot, when in fact the people that they were going in to liberate were the ones who were most hell-bent on killing them. And so I told the story of the first 500 that were killed by name, by day, by incident. And what I found is that not only were only five of the first 500 Americans killed by a defending military unit, meaning that 495 were killed by the people that we allegedly were going in to liberate, that the American government deliberately deceived the American people and the families of those who were killed. And when they were killed by friendly fire, they said, no, they died in combat by the enemy. When they were killed by an accident, they would say the same thing. It was all a lie. And recognizing that if they told the truth about how the first 495 of 500 Americans died in those wars, that Americans would have said much sooner, hell no, get us out of there. We ought not be here. There's no way to prevail here. The U.S. government routinely lies, even to the families of those whose life have been stolen by the malfeasance of this government. So, as we continue to look at Zubair, the head of Al-Shabaab, the lads of Somalia, he was said to have been involved in the abduction and murder of several foreign workers in Somaliland, including the killing of an Italian aid worker. A woman in 2003. Well, kidnapped is part of Islam. Kidnapped for ransom in particular is part of Islam. That's why you have these Somali pirates that act so freely. And murder is also part of Islam. As you study the words and deeds of Muhammad, you'll find that he routinely sent out his militants to go assassinate individuals he did not like, and that he ultimately financed Islam in large part through kidnap for ransom. But bin Laden, we're told, was wary of a merger with al-Shabaab. Now, it's interesting that all of these groups, like al-Shabaab, are always presented as well as the Islamic State in Iraq. They're always presented as being al-Qaeda affiliates. And what we learned when we invaded al-Qaeda's head's lair, wolf's den, if you will, eagle's den in Pakistan, was that he had absolutely no influence over the group that we were saying was al-Qaeda in Iraq, no influence over the group that claimed to be al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, no influence over al-Shabaab. In fact, he was berating them. All of his correspondence with those that the United States wanted to associate with al-Qaeda, the head of al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, was berating, saying, you're not doing anything in my name. I want nothing to do with you. And so bin Laden said, no, I don't want a merger of al-Qaeda with al-Shabaab. No way. Now, Ayman Zawahiri took a different view. He's a organizer. He wanted more of these groups to appear linked. But bin Laden, the opposite was true. So when we raided his compound in 2010, we learned that this notion of calling these Islamic cells around the world, these various Islamic terrorist groups, al-Qaeda linked, was a complete lie. And yet, even in light of the published documentation from that raid, most journalists like this one simply ignore it. We'll return with Shattering Myths after the news and commercial break.